Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, from Campaign Number 9, from Cowpens to Guilford Courthouse. We pick up the story on March 15, 1781, and American General Nathanael Greene has chased British General Lord Cornwallis to Guilford Courthouse in North Carolina, and we're on the verge of the battle that day. The British, hungry, tired, and on the march since 4 in the morning on March 15, 1781, approached American General Nathanael Greene's army from the New Garden Quaker Meeting House, 8 miles to the southwest. British Colonel Tarleton's cavalry led the British column, followed by the foot regiments and artillery. American cavalry under Colonel Light Horse Henry Lee sparred with British Colonel Tarleton's horsemen in a series of early morning sharp skirmishes along the Great Salisbury Road leading to the courthouse, then fell back to the rebel lines with their fighting blood up. The first line of the American army was on a wooded ridge overlooking muddy, stubbled farm fields the enemy would have to cross, and consisted for the most part of largely untested North Carolina militia companies behind a split-rail fence at the forest edge. To bolster this line, veteran riflemen and Continental Dragoons secured each flank. Imitating American General Morgan on the night before the Battle of Cowpens, the mounted American General Nathanael Greene inspired his men by telling them to fire two volleys. They could fall back through the brushy woods to the second line of two Virginia militia brigades once the British regulars closed in. British General Lord Cornwallis was on the offensive, and he wasted little time preparing for the attack. Once Cornwallis reached a small farmstead belonging to the Hoskin family that straddled the New Garden Road, Cornwallis deployed his army of 1,900 men on either side of the road. On the army's right, the troops were led by General Leslie, who had joined Cornwallis in South Carolina with reinforcements just after the Battle of Cowpens. Leslie now commanded the 2nd Battalion of the 71st Regiment, the Regiment von Boes, a Hessian battalion, and two battalions of the elite guards, men drawn for American service from all three British Guards regiments in London and commanded by British General Charles O'Hara, a popular officer. On the left side of the road, Lieutenant Colonel James Webster commanded the red-coated troops with the 23rd Foot posted immediately north of the road, and next to them the 33rd Foot, both very experienced British regiments. Behind them were the tall grenadiers and nimble light infantry of the guards. The elite companies of the British regiments, along with a company of rifle-bearing Hessian light infantry called Jaegers. The commanding general placed several canyons of Royal Artillery in the road, with Colonel Tarleton's legion behind them, ready to exploit anticipated success against the Americans. Artillery on both sides opened the contest, firing from the sandy road by about 1 in the afternoon. After 30 minutes of this exchange, British General Lord Cornwallis sent his troops forward to attack the rebel militia. When the redcoats advanced uphill to about 100 yards from the militia line, the Carolinians let loose. A most galling and effective fire, wrote one British officer, many of them resting their weapons on the top fence for better accuracy. The bloodied redcoat regiments and one Hessian battalion paused to regroup after suffering fearful casualties, but returned the rebel fire and charged ahead with bayonets fixed. It is unclear how many of the Carolinians fired a second or even a third volley of musketry, but soon all retreated through the woods, some in a state of panic, scattered in every direction, one of them later recalled. Colonel Lee later recalled with disdain that he joined in the attempt to rally the fugitives, threatening to fall upon them with his cavalry. All was vain, so thoroughly confounded with these unhappy men, that throwing away arms, knapsacks, and even canteens, they rushed like a torrent headlong through the woods. Later, a frustrated American General Nathanael Greene would tell Congress that the Carolinians waited the attack until the enemy got within about 140 yards, when part of them began a fire, but a considerable part left the ground without firing at all. Some fired once and some twice, and none more, except a part of a battalion of General Eaton's brigade. The general and field officers did all they could to induce the men to stand their ground, but neither the advantages of position nor any other consideration could induce them to stay. They left the ground, and many of them threw away their arms. The Crown forces, though bloodied, pressed forward towards the Virginians in the forest and brush several hundred yards away. The thickly wooded terrain, however, disrupted tight British unit alignments, so that their assault on the waiting Virginians was disjointed and of almost infinite diversity, according to a British Army witness. The fighting in the late winter forest was confusing, and made more so by the dense blue smoke of the musket fire. Still, the Virginia militia gave the enemy a warm reception and kept up a heavy fire for a long time, boasted General Greene, who could hear from the courthouse area the roar of the shooting. Eventually, British Lord General Cornwallis's men pressed the Virginians back with bayonet charges and superior discipline, but they suffered heavy casualties in their advance. A British soldier declared that the second line of the enemy made a braver and stouter resistance than the first. Posted in the woods and covering themselves with trees, they kept up for a considerable time a galling fire which did great execution. Although some of the Virginia militiamen fled in panic, almost 500 men from the first and second lines did regroup around the courthouse to the rear of Greene's third line. Meanwhile, on the far right of Lord Cornwallis's line, a separate battle began to develop away from the main scene of action. British and Hessian troops, including a detachment of Colonel Tarleton's feared dragoons, pushed Virginia riflemen under Colonel William Campbell and Colonel Henry Lighthorse Henry Lee's mixed legion of cavalry and infantry south through the woods, away from the American left flank. Many of Greene's soldiers in this part of the field were killed or suffered saber wounds from slashing British cavalrymen. But Lord Cornwallis's troops were hard hit too. An American rebel rifleman recalled years later that he received two wounds at the bayonet of Guilford Courthouse, wounds occasioned by a ball having been shot in his right leg and by a blow from a British light horse's man's sword on the left hand. At one point in the fighting, near the second American line, gun smoke and dense brush obscured the landscape to such an extent that Lord Cornwallis was almost captured. Lucky for him, a British sergeant of the 23rd Regiment grabbed the bridle of the general's mount and brought him to safety. I then mentioned to him that if his lordship pursued in the same direction, he would in a few moments have been surrounded by the enemy and perhaps cut to pieces or captured, wrote the redcoat ranker. Finally, about 90 minutes after the fluid battle opened, tired British troops approached American General Greene's third line, which to that point had been unengaged in the fight. Initially, the 1st Maryland and 2nd Virginia regiments soundly repulsed a British attack from Webster's troops on the rebel right, but on the rebel left, the inexperienced 2nd Maryland broke and fled almost instantly when attacked close to the New Garden Road by General Harris' 2nd Battalion of Guards, which also captured two American 6-pounder cannons close to the courthouse as they surged forward. General Harris' successful attack put his men in the rear of the steadfast 1st Maryland, which, once warned of the danger, faced about and gave some well-directed fires in close combat. Joining the attack on the British guards was Colonel Washington's Continental Light Dragoons, which charged straight into the British guards' ranks with about 80 mounted men, who then made a second pass through the enemy troop formation, slashing and firing. In this confused action, the 1st Maryland was able to recapture some prisoners, and the bitter fighting was hand-to-hand. Several blasts of cannon fire from the nearby British lines soon checked the danger from Colonel Washington's cavalry. All of the British regiments were now up to the third line, and General Greene had engaged in heavy fighting, including in the ignominious rout of the 2nd Maryland. He concluded that a withdrawal from the field was now prudent. At about 3:30 in the afternoon, Greene's forces withdrew from the field in good order and made their way north on the Reedy Fork Road to Spedwell Iron Works on Troublesome Creek, the Army's pre-designated rallying point. British forces initially pursued but were checked by Virginia Continentals as rain began to fall on the dead and wounded left in the field. It was one of the most hazardous as well as severe battles that occurred during the war, later wrote Colonel Tarleton. American General Greene, taking some solace in the disappointing result of the long, obstinate, and bloody contest, wrote to the Continental Congress that the British have met with a defeat and a victory, while Major St. George Tucker of the Virginia Militia concluded that Cornwallis undoubtedly gained a dear-bought victory. American losses were 79 killed, 184 wounded, and 1,046 missing, most of the latter being militiamen who fled the field and did not return to the ranks. General Greene's army lost 4 guns to the Redcoats as well. British General Lord Cornwallis lost 93 killed, 413 wounded, and 26 missing, a staggering casualty rate of about 25%. His army held the bloody field, but at great cost. Another such victory would ruin the British Army, quipped Charles James Fox, a prominent member of the British Parliament who opposed the war. Although much of Greene's militia had left the army for home during the retreat to Spedwell Iron Works, Greene still had a force of which the British had to be wary. Given Cornwallis's losses, the British commander knew he only had won a Pyrrhic victory. He left about 70 of his severely wounded soldiers among the Quakers at the New Garden Meeting House and began to march his men south by easy marches to Cross Creek. He brought his worn down troops to Wilmington on the lower Cape Fear River in North Carolina on April 7th. As Cornwallis marched south along the Cape Fear River towards the coast, General Greene followed him part of the way to Ramsay's Mill on the Deep River. Cornwallis managed to avoid a battle against Greene's command and reached Williamton in a few days. Greene then decided to move his army into South Carolina with 1,200 Continentals and several hundred militia rather than chase the enemy to Wilmington. He explained his plan to General George Washington from North Carolina, stating, "I am determined to bring the war immediately into South Carolina. The enemy will be obliged to follow us or give up their posts in that state. If the former takes place, it will draw the war out of North Carolina and give it an opportunity to raise its proportion of men. If they leave their posts to fall, they must lose more than they can gain here. If we continue in this state, the enemy will hold their positions in both. All things considered, I think the movement is warranted by the soundest reasons, both politically and militarily. The maneuver will be critical and dangerous." General Greene was risking leaving the army in the rear once he entered South Carolina. He explained to a staff officer that by moving south, the enemy now have almost entire command of the supplies of the state, and by going there, we shall be able to share it with them at least. By April 19, 1781, General Greene's army was just north of Camden. British General Lord Cornwallis elected not to follow Greene south, but rather to march north to Virginia and the Chesapeake Bay region. He reported to his superior, Lieutenant Sir Henry Clinton, in New York, "Until Virginia is in a manner subdued, our hold of the Carolinas must be difficult, if not precarious. The rivers of Virginia are advantageous to an invading army, but North Carolina is, of all the provinces in America, the most difficult to attack, unless material assistance could be got from the inhabitants, the contrary of which I have sufficiently experienced, on account of the great extent of the numberless rivers and creeks and total want of interior navigation." Cornwallis's troops were made ready to renew their southern campaigns of long marches and bloody battles, and left Wilmington on April 25th, bound for Virginia. 6 months later, most of them were killed, wounded, or made prisoners at Yorktown when Cornwallis surrendered his weary soldiers to Washington's army, which was allied with French troops and naval assets. In the Carolinas, General Greene managed to keep his army together through logistical difficulties, financial challenges, and three major battles until the British finally evacuated their posts in the South in 1783. Always pithy with his words, the Rhode Island American general neatly summed up much of the American experience in the Revolutionary War in the South by stating, "We fight, get beat, rise, and fight again." That concludes campaign number 9, from Cowpens to Guilford Courthouse, the campaign against the British in the Carolinas. We turn now to campaign number 10 in the 10 key campaigns of the American Revolution. En avant to victory, the Allied marched to Yorktown, June to October 1781. The final campaign. Campaign number 10 includes the Battle of Hobkirk's Hill on April 25th, 1781. The Battle of Eutaw Springs, September 8th, 1781, and the March to Yorktown, June to September 17th, 1781, the Battle of Chesapeake, September 5th, 1781. As the winter of 1780 to 1781 turned into spring, the Continental Army, plagued by lingering discontent that erupted in open mutiny in early January, barely maintained its strength. George Washington had written despairingly on April 9th to Lieutenant Colonel John Loudons, who was about to depart for France to once again plead for assistance from the French King Louis XVI, stating, "We are at the end of our tether, and now or never our deliverance must come." If the grueling struggle for independence was to end in victory, the campaign of 1781 would preferably end, as far as Washington was concerned, in the conquest of New York City. The ardently desired victory was indeed won in the fall of 1781. Not along the banks of the Hudson River in New York, however, but in George Washington's home state of Virginia. In late September, 6 months after he had laid bare his uttermost fears to Lawrence, American and French soldiers and sailors cast an impregnable siege around British forces at Yorktown. Surrounded on water and on land, British Lord General Charles Lord Cornwallis ordered his men to lay down their arms in the early afternoon of October 19th, 1781. A perfectly executed naval campaign, close Franco-American land-sea coordination, and a great deal of good luck turned 1781 into an annus mirabilis, a wonderful, miraculous year. The victory at Yorktown not only assured American independence, but also brought the nation together on a human level as New Englanders and Southerners got to know each other while fighting for a common cause. For over 100 days, thousands of soldiers marched, rode, and sailed from Newport, Rhode Island, and Newburgh, New York, to Yorktown, Virginia, encountering fellow Americans and cultures far from their own homes. The march to victory became a crucial step in the development of an American identity in the cauldron of the war and the diversity of revolutionary America. Personal encounters with her French brothers in arms dispelled decades-old prejudices, making Americans realize who they were by recognizing who they were not. Until 1780, Americans had viewed their French allies with suspicion and sometimes contempt. Personal encounters changed that perception. William Channing of Newport, Rhode Island, wrote of the French on August 6, 1780, stating that, "Neither officers nor men are the effeminate beings we were heretofore taught to believe them to be. They are as large and as likely men as can be produced by any nation." Colonel John Fontaine of Virginia wrote on October 26, 1781, stating that, "The French are very different from the ideas formerly inculcated in us of a people living on frogs and coarse vegetables. George Washington had once been opposed to bringing French ground forces to the United States. By the winter of 1779-1780, however, American and French leaders both decided they had no choice but to send a strong force across the ocean to rescue the Revolution. On March 17, 1780, French King Louis XVI of France promoted Jean-Baptiste Donatien de Vermeer, Comte Rochambeau, to lieutenant general and put him in charge of a mission codename Expedition Particulière. On May 2nd, a convoy of 32 transports and cargo ships, protected by 7 ships of the line, 4 frigates, 4 fleets, a cutter, and a schooner, left Brest for the United States. Besides their crews of about 7,000 soldiers, the French troops carried the Bourbonnais, Sansonese, Santonge, and Royal Dupont regiments of infantry of about 1,000 men each. A reinforced battalion of the Yaxon Regiment of Artillery with a strength of about 450, the 600-man-strong Lanzun's Legion, and a pioneer detachment, altogether about 450 officers and 5,300 men. Around 10:30 in the morning on July 11th, the French fleet, under the command of Charles Henri Louis d'Aussac, Chevalier de Tournai, sailed into Newport Harbor. After more than 70 days on the ocean, about 800 soldiers and some 150 sailors were afflicted with scurvy, and hundreds of them died over the next few weeks. Rochambeau, anyway, had arrived too late in the season to embark on a campaign in 1780. On September 22nd, he met with George Washington in Hartford, Connecticut, where they decided to wait until the following spring before finalizing campaign plans. On November 1st, Rochambeau's infantry entered winter quarters in Newport, while the hussars of Lauzun's Legion and their horses were sent to Lebanon, Connecticut. Several months later, from May 21st to May 23rd, 1781, the generals met in Wethersfield to discuss their plans. On May 22nd, George Washington summarized the decisions in his diary, stating that the French land force, except 200 men, should march as soon as the squadron could sail from Newport, Rhode Island, for Boston, to the North River, and there, in conjunction with American, to commence an operation against New York, which in the present reduced state of the garrison it was thought would fall unless relieved, or to extend our views to the southward as circumstances and a naval superiority might render them more necessary and eligible. In view of the insurmountable difficulty and expense of land transportation, the waste of men in long marches, especially where there is a disinclination to service, objections to the climate, and so forth, an attack on New York remained preferable to any objective for 1781 by the American Army. On May 28th, Rochambeau informed Admiral François-Joseph Paul Comte de Grasse, the commanding officer of French naval forces in the West Indies, that George Washington had asked for the march of the French forces to the North River to threaten and maybe attack New York in cooperation with his army in order to create a diversion for the southern states. Asking for de Grasse's cooperation, Rochambeau continued, "There are 2 points at which an offensive can be made against the enemy, Chesapeake and New York. The southwesterly winds and the state of defense in Virginia will probably make you prefer the Chesapeake Bay, and it will be there where we think you may be able to render the greatest service, whereas you'll need only 2 days to come from there to New York. In any case, it is essential that you send, well in advance, a frigate to inform de Barras where you are to come, and also George Washington." This letter has often been cited as evidence that the Yorktown campaign had been planned at Wethersfield, but the facts do not bear out this interpretation. George Washington had had no intelligence from Virginia since May 5th, When Marie-Joseph Paul Yves Roche-Gabert de Motier, the Marquis de Lafayette, informed him that Lord Cornwallis had left Wilmington, North Carolina on April 25th. On May 20th, Lord Cornwallis was in Petersburg, a fact not known in New Windsor until June 4th. No one could predict where Cornwallis would be in September, and as long as he remained far inland, de Grasse's fleet would be of little help, no matter when or with how many ships he entered the Chesapeake. Reading from Campaign Number 10, in Avant to Victory, the Allied March to Yorktown, June to October 1781, in the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, will be continued. This has been American History. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.